What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello and welcome to Sports by Northwest. I'm Bill Warren, the sports columnist at The Oregonian. It is spring in the Pacific Northwest, which means it is spring football in the Pacific Northwest, which we're going to dive into today. I'm joined by two of the state of Oregon's foremost experts. You know what? The two foremost experts on college football in the state of Oregon are beat writers on the Ducks and Beavers, James Crepia down in Eugene, and Nick Daschle, the king of Corvallis. Gentlemen, how are we doing this fine rainy April day?
Doing well, Bill. How are you?
Not bad. Just made my one trip to Corvallis this week because they only open up one practice a week. So,
well, I mean, let's talk about these spring practices. For several weeks, both the Ducks and Beavers have been getting it in, preparing for next season. Both teams were 10-3 last year. The Beavers won the rivalry game. Both teams won their bowl games, and I think, you know, we talked at the end of last year about 10-3 being a real triumph for Oregon State, and 10-3 being a bit of a disappointment for the Ducks. Real quickly, just why don't you guys each give me one thing you've learned from your respective beats, and then we'll dive into it a little bit deeper. But what's one thing you've learned in spring practice so far about your team, starting with James?
Well, so far, there has not been a truly like shocking development or anything like that, I'd say. We've gotten a little bit of context and stuff with the new offense and Will Stein coming in. And again, not a shocker that things went well, so they're not going to reinvent the wheel. Things are going to be relatively the same. But again, that wasn't really a huge surprise. I don't know if I'd say I'd learned that per se. Certainly some position battles that, again, weren't surprising, but starting to see exactly where some folks are fitting in. Say learned would be probably a couple of guys maybe at some new positions or just a little bit of movement. A guy like Jamal Hill going from deep safety and a little bit of nickel safety to the second level and working more with the inside backers. Not a stunning move, but a move nevertheless. That, you know, one of the questions would have been for entering the offseason, how do they go about moving personnel or not? How do they go about filling certain positions where they were a little bit thinner, inside backer being one of them? They brought in a couple of transfers. And now since spring has started in the last week, had one of the transfers who left over the weekend was at that position. So that would probably be, I'd say, one of them that would truly be in the category of learned. It was just moving some personnel around and how they're trying to fill some holes.
And it's such a good point that kind of underscores what you're saying, James. Spring football is not necessarily when the big sledgehammers, the big wow sledgehammers come down the pike annually. This is a chance for, I mean, obviously a chance for the coaches to get hands on the players, a chance for them to start implementing, like you said, you know, a different offense with Will Stein replacing Kenny Dillingham. And Nick, how about in Corvallis? What has been the biggest takeaway so far? And I would also note Oregon State has their spring game on Saturday, this upcoming Saturday, the 22nd. The Ducks, the Saturday that follows on the 29th down in Eugene. But Nick, take it away.
So, I mean, it's a little difficult to come up with a great takeaway on what they've done this spring, partially because, you know, we've only seen a half a dozen practices. And Jonathan's been really cautious on veterans. If they have any, you know, anything at all, they sit. They don't practice. And so there's been a lot of guys that we know are going to, you know, play in the fall, just haven't been out there for whatever reason. But I'd say probably the biggest thing is that the defense looks like it's going to be okay. I mean, they lost a lot of veterans off last year's defense, particularly in the secondary, but it appears, you know, these guys, the replacements they got, they've been recruiting better, you know, year after year with Jonathan, and these guys that have been waiting their turn, they appear to be, you know, they, at least this spring, appear to be okay. The secondary, especially in the, you know, the safety position is really, really looks good, and the defensive line looks pretty good. So Jonathan's even said that this is the best defensive line he's had in his 6 years at Oregon State. So You know, that's been those are the two questions. There's been two questions going in. One is, you know, what are they going to do with quarterback? And second, you know, can the defense pick it up from a year ago? And I think defensively they'll be okay.
So let's talk about that quarterback position with the Beavers, Nick, because I don't think Oregon State has never gotten a transfer or a player with the pedigree or reputation that their new quarterback, DJ Uiagalelei, comes in with after being a five-star recruit out of California, going to Clemson, started for a few years at Clemson. I think, you know, was seen as a guy who was going to be in the mix for Heisman trophies when he got to Clemson. Things obviously turned south there, and he finds himself at Oregon State. And, you know, that feels like a slam dunk for the Beavers, minus the fact that they have an incumbent quarterback who, in Ben Gulbrandsen, who was the backup last year, won, what, he goes 7-1 last year as the starter?
Yeah.
I guess from where I sit, you bring in DJ because he's going to be the starting quarterback, and you don't disrespect Ben by saying, you know, you're going to be the backup again, because he deserves better treatment than that. How do you view this quarterback situation? Is there a quarterback battle, and is it possible that Ben Gulbrandsen is the quarterback when they open the season at San Jose State in September?
Well, first of all, you got to understand, Jonathan, you bring in a quarterback like DJ, there's a lot of programs that kind of have this implied, you're the guy, you're going to be our guy next year. That's not the way Jonathan works. He's going to watch spring, he's going to watch August, and he's going to play the best guy. He is just one of these guys that's just not married to, you know, making promises to anybody. So In that sense, Ben's got a chance. He's got a chance to start. And, you know, through, what are we on? We're at 12 practices. I mean, it's a coin flip right now. And then you throw in Aiden Childs, the freshman kid, who I don't think is going to play because he's, you know, 175 pounds, 180 maybe. But he's got some tools. But I just think, he's going to need a year. But he looks the part. But I, and DJ has got to learn how to play under center, because that's a lot of Oregon State's offense. He didn't do that at Clemson, so that's part of what he's doing this spring, is learn how to play under center. He doesn't appear to throw the prettiest ball in the world, but you know, as long as he gets to the receivers, I just at this point I would just say it's a coin flip, and you know, let's see. And Jonathan's not going to make a decision going into, you know, coming out of spring. And I even asked Brian Lindgren yesterday, you know, could this go into the season? And, you know, he didn't rule it out. I think there's a good chance they may play both of them, at least early, you know, those first couple games, just to, because it's San Jose State, it's UC Davis, it's San Diego State. It's not, you know, those are games they should win. And I could see that. I'm not saying they're going to do that, but I could see them doing that.
When you talk about not throwing the prettiest ball, I mean, he's in competition with, you know, Gulbrandsen, who was an incredible game manager for the Beavers last year. But I mean, you look at the games they struggled, you know, against Oregon, he didn't throw the ball their entire comeback because he seemed to be only able to find, you know, the Duck secondary when he put it in the air. So I mean, there's some familiarity with quarterbacks. Oh,
I mean, in Gulbrandsen's defense, a little bit. He didn't have a lot of great weapons.
Sure.
I mean, how do things change if he has Luke Musgrave? I mean, it's an enormous change. And this year they've got some tight ends, I think, that can make a difference. You know, Jack Velling will be in his second year, and he was starting to come on late last year. And then they got Jermaine Terry, who looks like he can run, block, and get downfield. So those two guys should make a difference.
Nick, one other thing, then we're going to transition to the Ducks for a minute. But one thing that is a theme with this Beavers team, last year it was that they kind of wanted to catch everybody by surprise, and that they were raising their own expectations, even though they were still seen as, you know, a middle-of-the-pack Pac-12 team. They ended up being one of the five teams that won 10 games. This year the expectations are going to be higher. And, you know, there's every reason for them to talk about, you know, being in the mix at the top of the conference. They have not had expectations like that, you know, since the Mike Riley era. You know, it's been a decade or more since anybody would dare utter conference championship around Corvallis. How do you see the Beavers handling these increased expectations that nobody really affiliated with this Oregon State program has experienced, at least in this stretch of time?
I mean, it's unknowable. Because the leadership of last year's team is pretty much gone, and so they're going to have to turn to new guys to get these to get the team to, you know, go through the dog days of summer and, you know, put in the time and take this seriously. And by all accounts, they appear to be doing that. But until we get to the season, you know, we don't know for sure how they can handle being a team that people are projecting to win, you know, 8, 9, 10 games. You know, last year they won 10 games, but there weren't a lot of people out there expecting them to win 10 games. They're expected to do that this year. And so, you know, that's just unknowable till you get in. If they had last year's veterans on this team, I'd say, yeah, better chance of that. But, you know, do we know that Ketan Oladapo is a guy everybody can rally around? Probably, but he hasn't been in that spot yet. You know, is the quarterback, you know, we don't know who the quarterback's going to be. Will they rally around whoever that guy is? And just, you know, they lost Jaden Grant and Brandon Kipper, who've been in the program 7 and 6 years. Those guys were rocks on both sides. They're both gone, so they're gonna have to find new guys to rally behind. Those leaders, they've got to get them, you know, get this team focused, you know, going into August. And, you know, we'll just have to see whether that happens or not.
Jaden Grant and Brandon Kipper, I think, were in your freshman class at Oregon State, if I'm not mistaken, Nick.
Yeah, you're too funny.
James, similarly with what Nick was saying about the quarterbacks, are we in for a big battle at Oregon between Ty Thompson and Bo Nix?
No.
Or is that pecking order is pretty established?
Nope. Next question. No, there is there's no debate to be had, and that's not knocking anyone. That's just, you have one of the best returning quarterbacks, if not just in the league, in the country. End of discussion.
So I mean, obviously, I was being cute, but when we talk about Bo Nix, I mean, he was the story of the year last year at Oregon, and he will be again. His return was a huge development for them. What changes for him in Will Stein's offense as opposed to Kenny Dillingham's, and is that what we're going to be talking about next year? Is Bo Nix in a different system, or is it going to? I mean, we saw what worked for Bo Nix last year, and he was very comfortable. He thrived. They took advantage of his tools fully, I would say, right up until the point he got injured. I would assume that Will Stein and his boss, Dan Lanning, are smart enough not to go away from all that.
Yeah, no, they're not. They're not going to. As I say, they're not reinventing the wheel here. We haven't seen in a competitive setting just yet one spring scrimmage in, even though, you know, the masses were not permitted to so much as be in the building, let alone look at the field. But they're not going to be reinventing the wheel. Anything that you've seen of Will Stein's offense from UTSA tells you that. And you know that by anything that you've seen by way of highlights of that. From the multiple seasons, by the way, not just going off what he did last year. They have, you know, what Stein has shown in his limited time as a coordinator at the college level is that he is able to utilize personnel when personnel changes. You know, a couple of years ago, UTSA had, I believe he had like 1,300 or 1,400 yards rushing, maybe even more than that. And they lost that running back. Naturally, they threw a lot more. Mm-hmm. And they had a lot of really dynamic receivers. When they had dynamic receivers, they found them the ball. And they've had a pretty good quarterback down there who they got to stay around even with multiple members of the coaching staff, the offensive coaching staff, leaving for bigger and better opportunities this past offseason. So he's utilized and gotten the most out of the personnel he's had as a coordinator. And with that said, you come in and you inherit a great quarterback who's coming off a career year. Yeah, they're not going to be reinventing the wheel and asking him to do a whole bunch of things that he hasn't done before or to put him in uncomfortable positions or something. They're still going to be doing a lot of the things that they did under Kenny Dillingham schematically. I think the greater question that's still going to be unknown even at the end of spring, exactly, because I'm not sure Oregon's done adding certain offensive players and weapons around Bo, is what changes, less so in terms of the scheme or by name of the coordinator, and more so in the weapons around him. And does that lead to changes where, when you have a Bucky Irving back who by statistics, is the best returning back and most productive returning back in the league, and one of the top 10 in the country, maybe even top 5 in the country, and you have a really productive receiver in Troy Franklin, that's a lot to build around. And you bring in a Tez Johnson, you bring in a Trayshon Holden from Alabama. All right, and again, they may not be done. They're in the mix for Gary Bryant Jr., the transfer from USC, and maybe even others. So they've got weapons. They've added weapons. Does that make them – how much better does that make them? And as much as we talk about the offense and change there, frankly, I think the defense only has one direction to go, and you had a top 20 offense. What does a improved defense do to enhance the offense? And that's going to be an impact on the team regardless of by position or anything. That just in general, because like I say, Oregon's defense really only has one direction to go statistically. So when I say improved, it's a relative term, but improved. What does a better defense do for an offense that was already in the top 20 in every meaningful statistic?
What has Dan Lanning's message been about the defense? Because, I mean, listen, this is a defensive coach. I mean, he has this job because of what he did with the defenses in the SEC, notably Georgia. He brought in Tosh Lupoi, who comes in with a great recruiting background, and obviously has worked in all the right places. But that defense, like you said, wasn't on the same level as the offense. What has Lanning said about how they close that gap in his second year?
Well, they've talked about not just by words but by actions over the last 4-plus months since the season ended. You see that the roster churn that they've had, and it remains ongoing, has been most impactful on the defensive side of the ball. I mean, what were the areas that they were most deficient by far? Pass rush, mm-hmm. which was bad in 21, actually got worse in 22. Now, losing Kayvon Thibodeau is a part of that, yes. But they were historically bad in 21 and got even worse without him. Well, you have to get to the pass. You have to get to the quarterback. You have to get to the passer. Well, they brought in a Jordan Burch, who in the transfer market this offseason has been and is still the best available pass rusher that was there for the taking. They got him. They need probably more. They signed, in their among the high school portion of the class, the biggest glut of that was not just on defense in general, but on the edge. Now, you're not going to necessarily lean on all those freshmen to be the immediate fix, but yeah, they've tried to address it insofar as they can, and they might still address it if somebody else ends up in the portal who's, to their liking on the edge. I don't think that's going to stop them from trying to, you have to get to the quarterback more. Yes.
Yeah.
That impacts the pass defense in general. You lose the best corner in the league, if not possibly the top corner taken in this year's draft in a week, in Christian Gonzalez. That might only have one direction to go conversely. And you shut down nearly half the field with him, and you still weren't good at defending the pass. How much of that is on relative quality of corners and scheme, and how much of that is on lack of pass rush? Probably both. The answer to that is yes. That's why I say, it can only have one direction to go in terms of pass rush, even with losing DJ Johnson. The strength of the team is the defensive line, but does that include the edge? Still a bit of a question mark. Even with Jordan Burch, still a little bit of a question mark. You don't have, one guy doesn't solve all answers because, again, they had Kayvon Thibodeau. He didn't go out there and have 15 sacks because everybody in the country who they played tried to double-team him a lot. And they're going to do that to Burch, too. So question still remains, how much more can they get there? So to your question of what have they said about it, they've done it by action. Mm-hmm. In terms of words, some of it is read between the lines of, hey, we did what we could with what we inherited, i.e., maybe not everybody was exactly there to our liking and to what we're trying to do. And some of that led to departures by choice or by force. And others is, as they said, even Tosh Lupoi said, we're not happy. We're not satisfied. And, you got to look yourselves in the mirror and talk about, did you put people in the best position? And again, it doesn't have to say, and some of it goes unsaid. It's understood.
Sure.
They did not put Bennett Williams in a position to succeed when he gave up the touchdown, and it wasn't he gave up. The defense gave up the touchdown against Washington in the game-tying touchdown at the end of the game. They didn't. And we talked about it at the time, but that was one of several instances in where they're trying to get as much as you can out of players, but did you put them in position to succeed? And the answer was no. So again, it's not just about talent, know that. So they're going to try and put people in better positions, and by having more and better people in improved depth, they hope that that will enhance their ability to put them in better positions.
Nick, you had a good tweet this week. It was looking way, 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 way ahead into the crystal ball of Las Vegas. And the one betting line you could find on any of Oregon State's games next season was in the Oregon game, Oregon State in Eugene this year. And it was the Ducks -7.5, making Oregon a better than touchdown favorite in that game. I want each of you to answer this, both Nick and James. Is that too high, too low, or just right, given the fact we know absolutely nothing about what the state of these teams is going to be come November 24th? But for a way too early betting line, for our friends who might be listening in Las Vegas or inclined to throw some silly money at it, too high, too low, exactly right. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, that's what I wrote in the tweet, that how anybody could ever bet on that game at this moment, not knowing any of the injuries or situations or anything. I mean, you might as well just light a $100 bill on fire. I mean, who knows? But you know, if everything is as we know it today, I would say, yeah, 6-7 sounds about right. Sounds about right. I mean. I don't think it's going to be much higher than that unless there's some, you know, big injuries, or Oregon State's 4-7 going into the game, or, you know, somehow the Ducks only have 8 wins or something like that. But if things progress like, you know, we are anticipating, then, I could see the Ducks by about it. Because I think it was about a pick'em game at Corvallis, if I remember right. It opened the Ducks.
It jumped the fence right before kickoff.
It shifted lines historically never do. There was an incredible influx of late action on Oregon State in the 90 minutes leading up to kickoff.
Yeah, it was almost like somebody got tipped off that Knicks might not play or something. Something so bizarre that would cause something like that, but I don't know. Anyway, you would think that just based on how they put together lines, that sounds about right.
James, how about you?
If you were to put a line out now, I understand why it's, you know, that whether it's 7, 7.5, I get why it is. Myself, if I were in the business of doing it today, going strictly on the talent that we know of today, which again is going to be changed, I would want to know a lot more on May 5th. And the reason why I say the 5th is let until the end of the transfer window at the end of April 30th, but then the couple of day lag in data entry to know exactly who's in and out.
You just want to get to the margaritas on Cinco de Mayo.
Not for me. But no, I would love to know just in exactly who's, at least who's out, if not also who's in at both places, because again, every roster in the country is not done yet. I mean, until I know that, you know, at least a little bit more. But based on what we know today on April the 19th, I'd say I would probably go a little bit higher, but not a ton. At most, I would say 10 today. One, historically, no matter what, you know the weather conditions are going to be atrocious. I mean, that's just a given. So no matter what happens, the conditions are awful, rainy, soggy, misty, and all the above. After last year and the collapse that was, if Oregon at home has any opportunity to keep on pouring on, and if they're in the conversation for the playoff still at that point, let alone, you know, win and you're in the championship game, or even if they already have the championship game secured, if they're in contention for it, they are not going to be taking their foot off the gas. There's not going to be they're just going to try and ride this out. No, they're going to try and there's not going to be nursing of leads if they have it. So that's why I would say maybe a little more than 7.5, but I would definitely not go beyond 10 right now today, because you know it's just going to be played a certain kind of way stylistically, not just because it's this game or Oregon State does things a certain way offensively. No, it just is. It just is. And the weather condition is going to be awful, so you can't say, oh, even if Knicks turns into a 4,500-yard passer. You can't count on it on November the 24th or 25th.
Well, and I would also just say, when you consider last year, you know, what was the Oregon lead, James, before the collapse? 30-something to 10?
31-10, wasn't it?
31-10.
Yeah, it was a three-score lead. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about that being a close game, you know, at least at the line. Like, the Ducks were blowing it out of the water before the collapse. And I give tons of credit to Oregon State, but a lot of that was on Oregon as well. At home, like you said, after a loss like that, considering the influx of talent at Oregon, it does seem like going – and the reason I find this compelling is not just, oh, like, what should you do with your spare change, you know, for the Oregon-Oregon State game, but – at this moment in time, what team do we think is going to be better? That's something that matters locally. And, you know, last year, Oregon State was better, at least head-to-head. And as we kind of project out this season, who do we think is going to be better? You know, all those variables. But, I mean, I think what we're both kind of saying, especially – or what we're all saying, especially with Oregon at home, you would give the Ducks the edge. But, I mean, as we know in this game, I mean, impossible to predict. We saw that last year. We thought we had a pretty decisive answer in the third quarter, and then it flipped the other way. Last question from me, and if there's anything you guys want to add, we can get to that. But last year, the Pac-12 had a Heisman Trophy winner, Caleb Williams, at USC. I believe he enters the year as the favorite for the Heisman Trophy. My only question is for each of you, if there is another Heisman Trophy winner from the Pac-12 this year, who is it?
Hmm.
Or put differently, who in the Pac-12 has the best chance of winning the Heisman?
Well, the best chance is still going to be Caleb Williams. I mean, the best chance. If you're going to go, not just because, oh, well, he did it last year. No, because of the love fest that is with any prior year's award winner, regardless. I don't care where we are, even at the professional level. Anybody who did it the year before and had big statistics gets the bounce out of that. The established brand, if you will. And that goes with any level, anything, combined with the fact that he's still operating in Lincoln Riley's offense, and that while defenses in the league are improved, he's still probably going to light up a whole lot of teams, even without a Jordan Addison or Travis Dye in the backfield. They still have plenty of skill position talent, even if their offensive line still remains suspect. But if there is an alternative, I think the fact that both Michael Penix Jr. and Bo Nix are listed at basically even odds to each other. And you have to go with a quarterback in general. If you had to make a preseason pick kind of thing, I'm not saying that's absolutely the case, but if you're going to, you know, statistically speaking, if you're going to give yourself the best chance, you're going to pick a quarterback. I'd say the fact that those are even money guys to each other makes sense. Returning starters off really historically good years for them and their programs with weapons around them that they're both familiar with. In wide open offenses, yeah, probably. I haven't done a lot of deep analysis on that, but on first impression, yeah, probably one of the two of them would be, if not both of them, like I say, it's kind of even level. Yeah, they'd probably be the next guys, but I'm sure I'm missing someone. There's undoubtedly going to be somebody out there, the random Utah fan listening to this, be telling me I'm crazy not to mention Cam Rising and how great he is. But I'm sorry, Cam Rising's not going to put up the statistics, especially without the bell cow of a running back that he had to lean on the past couple of seasons. They're just not, or some of the tight end weapons yet. I don't know what the Utah offense will look like other than by scheme. I don't know what it'll look like statistically with Cam Rising this year without a Tavion Thomas or Dalton Kincaid. So,
yeah.
That said, again, somebody will probably pick Shador Sanders just because they're on the hype train at Colorado.
Nick, go ahead and make the Jaden DeMora argument for me. Do it.
I don't really have much to add there. It has to be a quarterback if it's the Pac-12. I mean, there's just if you're going to win in the Pac-12, you got your best player is probably going to be your quarterback. And I mean, those three guys that James mentioned are, you know, probably 1, 2, 3. I mean, Rising, you can't discount Rising only from the standpoint of if Utah wins the Pac-12. He's going to have to be great. So I don't know. I don't think they're going to win the Pac-12, but if they do, he's going to have to be great. So that would be the only reason to throw him in. And I really can't think of anybody else unless, you know, DJ somehow you know, has transformed into, you know, the five-star guy he was touted to be 2 years ago and plays twice as well as he did as a freshman at Clemson. I mean, and Oregon State goes, you know, 12-0 or something like that. I suppose there's that wild card, but I can't really think of anybody. You know, Stanford and Cal, no. UCLA, no. You know, Arizona State, no. You know, Colorado, I don't think they're not going to be a 10-2 team. So even if Sanders is great, he's not going to be under consideration. So,
are you saying that Colorado is not ready for primetime?
No, I'm not. If they get to a winning record, I'll be stunned.
It'd be a great turnaround. I mean, that's a tough job.
My only prediction for this upcoming season that Washington State is going to be the worst team in the league.
The Wazoo will be the worst team in the league.
I like that, James.
They will be the worst
team. The Wazoo will be the worst. Really? Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Only because I think there's multiple candidates for that distinction this year.
Well, they probably are, and I'm probably stepping out on a ledge, and the people on Coug Fan, if they hear this, will light me up. But, I mean, they just lost so many players. They
never acknowledge the existence of Coug Fan.
Well, it exists. But yeah, that's my only prediction on this one is that I just don't think Washington State's gonna be very good this year.
Well, again, there's just gonna be multiple candidates. I think the divide, which is always there in this league, I think is gonna be pretty stark at the bottom. And you know, last year obviously we saw that, but Colorado, again, only one direction to go. Even if they're not a world beater yet, they're gonna be considerably better than they were. ASU will be better than it was, but I still think ASU is in a, unless Rashada as a true freshman just is at levels the likes of which we've never seen before, with weapons that I believe are still relatively unknown at the moment, including a line as well. I think ASU is going to be in quite a building process under Dillingham. I think Cal could be really bad.
Really bad.
And Stanford, I know they're in a big change and you have no idea what to expect them offensively because it's going to be much more open than both historically or even the god-awful slow mesh that they tried to incorporate last year. But you want to talk about losing personnel. I think Stanford, Cal, and ASU are all going to be in the running there. If I had to pick today, I'd say Stanford's probably going to be the worst in the league in the fall. Just because, again, it's not just like everybody changing, but any number of question marks by way of who is the starting, go through the list. It's just humongous. And they had problems before, and I think they've got more of them, let alone the fact that there's new coaching staff. But that's part of a build. That's a hard job, too. And David Shaw probably doesn't get nearly enough credit and nearly enough love for exactly how, you know, good he made that, and made it look far easier than it actually was. And the fact that they did have the hurdles that they had historically, then now they're making things a bit easier for the transfer portal world, but it's still Stanford. They were lagging there. Then they had both Bay Area schools had the COVID restrictions that were the strictest in the country. All those things combined, I think the personnel on both teams, but especially Stanford this year, I think they could be in a world of hurt.
The only thing I'll say about Stanford as a proud and stubborn alumnus of the University of Montana is that Troy Taylor still gives me nightmares from his last few teams at Sacramento State. And you want to talk about jobs that are tough and were tough places to win. Sacramento State in the Big Sky Conference at the FCS level. I realize we're talking about different things here, but that was a very difficult job where nobody had ever had sustained success, and he turned that into a team that was in the mix for a national championship the last couple of years. So,
oh, he could be
Troy Taylor.
I think he'll be productive and efficient at points, but you still have to have weapons. You still have to have the Jimmys and Joes, and the question is how many Jimmys and Joes do they have right now? And I think he walked in at the wrong. Came a year ago. If Shaw had chosen to step away a year ago, I think he would have walked into a better personnel situation. Sure. Totally. I think the personnel situation that he walked into is what makes them, on April the 19th, a team that I would pick to be in the cellar this year in the league, just because I don't care who the coach is. Literally, Nick Saban could be at Stanford this year. If you don't have the players to do damn near anything you want to do, let alone what you can do. Yeah, and I just think they lost a lot of really talented and important players there. That at a place like Stanford, it is really hard to replace all of those guys at one time, let alone, again, the personnel lag that they had kind of just systemically been in the past couple of years. I think it's going to come back to haunt them this fall.
I just want to say, I think that might be the year's only reference where Montana and Stanford are included in the same sentence.
My joke always was that I went to the University of Montana, which is known as the Stanford of the West. So,
yeah, that is a joke.
Thank you, thank you.
I would say myself, Bill.
tells you about the education I got.
I never doubt at all or question your ability to get into either institution, Bill. So I personally think, you know, we can put them in the same. You could put it on your business card. Turn down Stanford to go to Montana. No one will question it. I mean.
No,
yeah.
No one would dare.
No.
Right? All right. Well, guys, hey, you've both been so busy, not only with spring football, but wrapping up basketball seasons, other spring sports. Nick, you've had Oregon State at the NCAA championships. James, both of you have baseball, softball. So I really appreciate you guys taking some time to share your wisdom and expertise. Obviously, if you've made it this far in the podcast, you're probably already reading their coverage at Oregon Live. But, I mean, Nick has been all over some of the stuff happening with the Beavers, including the son of Beavers great Reggie Tongue, moving from offense to defense just like his dad, a great conversation with Jaden Grant about his Oregon State experience, and James has obviously been all over spring football practice as well down at Oregon, and all the ins and outs and comings and goings with the Ducks. So we'll look forward to more of that as we get into the spring games. Like I said, Beavers this Saturday, April 22nd, the Ducks next Saturday, April 29th, and then a little bit of a pause before the real stuff starts later this summer. So, gentlemen, thank you to both of you for joining me. Nick Daschle, James Crepia, thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, we'll see you.
Thank you for listening to Sports by Northwest. Continue to support by reading, listening, and telling your friends about the Sports by Northwest podcast and all the great things happening at the Oregonian and Oregon Live. Thank you for listening.